No, you tell it.
No, you.
I'm not telling it.
You should totally tell it.
Well, you should tell it.
No, you tell it. No, You Tell It is a series that switches up the storytelling. So each performer writes a true life tale and then, switching with a partner, performs the other person's story, giving everyone involved the chance to share their own stories and experience someone else's. Today's Two on Tuesday stories are from our Glory show, recorded live at Jimmy's number 43. At first, Vicky Cabrera said to us, "I'll take the class, but I'll never do the show." She was in our very first workshop, and with a little coaching by Know You Tell It director Erica Iverson, she gave one of the most moving performances we've seen. Here she is performing Say Hi to Ellie, written by Ellie Dunn.
When I was 13 and my cousin Sarah was 3, I invented a game where she would repeat after me, pronouncing large words far beyond her comprehension, so that I, and everyone within earshot, could laugh at how they sounded in her cute little voice. Ubiquitous. Ubiquitous. Pharmaceutical. Pharmaceutical. Anti-disestablishmentarianism. Kenny some... Then she would shake her head and giggle, I would giggle back, and all the grown-ups in the room would crack up as well. My love for children is genuine, but I have to admit this was also my way of keeping some of the attention on me. I was the performer in the family, and as long as I was the one coaxing the cuteness from the toddler, my role as master of ceremonies was secure. I didn't care if it was the Ellie and Sarah show, as long as I had top billing. In addition to the pronunciation game, Sarah and I played hide-and-seek, tickle torture, and Super Sarah, where I would turn myself into a human carnival ride, flying her over my head as she squealed, "Again, Ellie Belly, again!" Our bond was so strong that she requested a birthday party with me and my girlfriends instead of with children her own age. We teenagers obliged, indulging her in an afternoon of swimming, rock painting, and cake gobbling. I can see now that Sarah chose to be surrounded by 13-year-olds instead of 3-year-olds because she liked being the only one of her kind, with all of the attention being lavished upon her and her alone. With my friends and me to play with, she got all the perks of being a little sister without having to share her parents with anyone. She had it made, until the day the baby came. I was 14 years old and Sarah was 4. My aunt had just given birth to Sarah's sister, Hillary Jane, and I could hardly wait to hold the new baby. My mom picked me up from school in the afternoon and took me straight to my aunt and uncle's house. I walked in and gave Sarah the usual giant squeeze and kiss hello before sitting on the couch and demanding, "Give me the baby." My aunt placed the chubby bundle of Hillary into my arms and I was instantly transfixed. I sat with the baby and gazed lovingly at her tiny features. I rocked and whispered and sang until she fell asleep. When I finally looked up, there was Sarah, standing on the other side of the room, glaring at me. Her preschool vocabulary wasn't fast enough to express her depth of feeling in that moment, but her eyes conveyed a very clear message. Traitor. How could you? Et tu, Ellie Belly? She had never looked at me that way before, but it didn't seem like a big deal. I dismissed it as a standard case of jealousy at the birth of a sibling, and I did my best to pay more attention to Sarah for the rest of that visit. Later, however, I would revisit this day in my memory and change its label from the day the baby came to the day Sarah stopped talking. At first, it seemed like a game. Shortly after the baby was born, my family went over to my aunt and uncle's for dinner, and Sarah wasn't speaking to anyone. She was happy to see us and bounced around in her usual impish way, but she wouldn't talk. It was definitely weird, but not something we worried about, especially since she didn't seem depressed or withdrawn. But the no-talking game continued beyond that evening. Soon, she stopped speaking to the neighbors, and then her nursery school friends, and then her teacher. Eventually, the only people she was talking to were those who lived with her, and she would only speak to them if no outsiders were present. It got to the point where my family dreaded going over there because it was just so awkward. When Sarah wanted something, she would run over to one of her parents and whisper in their ear. If we asked her a question, she would shrug or gesture weakly, or just look down and shift her attention to something else altogether. It was odd, and the resulting tension was palpable. But if one of us actually addressed it, my uncle would snap, saying it was nobody's business and he and his wife were handling it. We did our best to act as though everything was normal, but it wasn't. The family dynamic had definitely changed. Before, I was the court jester, able to silence the room and then fill it with laughter. Now, Sarah's silence was understage, and it was so deafening, it was all anyone could hear. As the years wore on, things got more serious. My aunt and uncle socialized as little as possible because they didn't like having to explain their voiceless daughter. Sarah had to be held back in school because of her inability to interact. My uncle's parenting tactics were all over the place, from coddling her to punishing her to teasing her in front of us, thinking that she would eventually want to get back at him by yelling out loud. Nothing worked. Then one day, my uncle called, sounding energized, because their therapist had referred them to a support group for parents with children who had what Sarah had, selective mutism, a psychiatric disorder in which a person who is normally capable of speech is unable to talk in given situations or to specific people. This was it. Not only did Sarah's issue have a label, there were other children who suffered from the same affliction. There would be strategies and solutions. There would be a cure. Joining the group made my aunt and uncle feel less alone, but it caused problems as well. They couldn't agree on a course of action because for every child they met who had recovered, there was another one who had not. They were terrified to try certain treatments because they were ruled by the fear that pushing Sarah too hard could result in some kind of full-on unknown psychosis. And yet, they managed to make progress. Some combination of individual therapy and group support resulted in Sarah slowly starting to speak to her classmates and teachers, then her neighbors and extended family, until finally, the only people left who she wouldn't speak to were the ones she stopped talking to first, my parents and me. I don't know what awful things Sarah thought would happen if and when she let us hear her voice, but it frightened her so much that she clung to her mutism with a fierce and disciplined grip. She had built a wall so strong and so high that she didn't know how to go about dismantling it, and she was scared to death that if she moved one brick, the whole thing would come crashing down on top of her. I was worried she would stay behind the wall forever, and the recollection of her accusatory face that day I held her baby sister made me wonder if it was my fault. Back home for the summer after my freshman year of college, I was in the kitchen making myself a snack when I heard a knock on the door. I opened it to find my uncle standing behind a sobbing Sarah, who was crying so hard she was almost choking. My uncle's face was red, and he looked more resolute than I had ever seen. He had a firm hold of Sarah's shoulders, and he steered her into the house, planted her a few feet in front of me, and said, "Say hi to Ellie." I stood rooted in my place. I hadn't heard Sarah utter a word in 5 years. She was 9 now, a much different little girl than the one who had called me Ellie Belly in a sweet infantile soprano. What would her voice sound like now? "Sarah," my uncle demanded, "say hi to your cousin Ellie right now." My mind was racing. Part of me was curious to see where this would lead, but the other part of me imagined the worst. What if forcing her backfired and she never spoke again? "It's okay," I said. "She doesn't have to." "Yes, she does. She has to do this right now, today. Sarah, say it. Say hi to Ellie." Tension, fear, a terrified girl in tears. "Say hi to Ellie." I was shaking, sweating, heart pounding, ears hot. "Say hi to Ellie." An intake of breath, an eternity, and then, "Hi," she croaked in a tiny, broken voice. "Hi, Sarah," I said, and then I lost it. My mother came out of her room and saw me and Sarah standing there crying, and my Uncle David's red face and clenched hands. "What's going on?" my mom said. "Sarah, say hi to Auntie Mary." "Hi, Auntie Mary," Sarah squeaked. "Hi, sweetie." And then my uncle let go. His body bent in half as he broke down and wept, and he quickly bolted out the door so his daughter wouldn't see. My mother and I hugged Sarah and praised her in an attempt to gloss over what had just happened. We offered her a flurry of words of encouragement and cookies and calmed her down until my uncle was composed enough to come back inside. "Can we go get my Mickey Mouse watch now, Daddy?" he said. That was the prize she had been offered in exchange for her words. "Yes, let's go get your watch." After their shopping trip, my uncle and Sarah returned with my aunt and now 5-year-old Hillary. They wanted us all to be together with Sarah, still talking to ensure that the day's success would stick. We were all sitting around the table eating fried chicken when my father came home from work. "Hi, Uncle Irk," Sarah said casually, as though the last 5 years had never happened. Her greeting was dismissive and firm all at once, as if she was embarrassed at what she had done and didn't want a fuss made over it. The rest of us held our collective breath, bracing ourselves for how my father would react. He seemed to know the importance of his response and that nonchalance was called for. "Hi, Sarah," he said breezily as he sifted through the mail. And we proceeded with our dinner like a normal family, every single one of us, chattering away. Group dinners like that are now few and far between. In recent years, our family has self-destructed with divorces, long-distance moves, and other miscellaneous drama. Sarah is our success story. She is 26 years old now and getting her master's degree in speech pathology. She's a fixer. She wants to help kids who have the same issues she had as a child. I'm still the performer in the family, trying to ease everyone's tension with my jokes. I guess that makes me a kind of fixer, too. Sarah and I are still super close, and she visits me in New York every year. We got together recently and reflected on her childhood and how ironic it is that she turned out to be the most well-adjusted person of us all. We did a lot of laughing, and then I asked her to do me a favor. I said, "Repeat after me. Pharmaceutical."
Now, switching it up, Ellie Dunn is one half of the hilarious comedy music duo Mel and Elle, whose latest creation, The Mommy Show, can be seen in venues all over New York City and beyond. Visit WelcomeToTheMommyShow.com. But before you do, listen to her perform Vicky Cabrera's story, Hitting the Wall, about the harsh consequences of what happens when procrastination is the only thing you exercise.
I look up at the wall in front of me. It must be 100 feet high, and I'm paralyzed with fear. I'm also soaking wet, freezing, and exhausted. Meanwhile, I'm surrounded by chaos, people grunting and panting as they push past me, charging forward to scale the giant wall. I just stand there. There's no way I can physically climb over that wall. No, definitely not. It's way too high. Not gonna make it. Game over. What am I doing? How the hell did I get here? 6 months earlier. My friend Janelle approached me about participating in the 2011 Men's Health Urbanathlon, a 10-mile endurance race in Queens that consists of running and a challenging urban obstacle course, which includes flights of stairs in Arthur Ashe Stadium and Citi Field, cargo nets, tire runs, and monkey bars, to name a few. I was hesitant. I've never been much of an athlete. I've made sporadic attempts to get in shape in the pursuit of personal health and fitness, but it never lasted long, and I'd always drift back into laziness once again. So I was skeptical, to say the least, but Janelle was determined to train for the event as part of her new weight loss goal. We could do it as part of a relay team and split the course among 3 people. Even though sharing the course seemed less daunting, I was still unsure, but reluctantly agreed. When Janelle described the course to me, it seemed doable. She was very convincing. So I thought to myself, okay, I'll give it a shot. This will be the motivation I need to get into shape. After we had 6 months to train for the event, plenty of time to get ready. A week passed. I'm making this higher.
Yeah.
Sorry. Pause. All right, now it'll be better. A week passed, and Janelle was already in full training mode, hitting the gym regularly. We work together, so one day she stopped by my desk to check in with me. Hey, Vix, have you started running yet? I hadn't. No, not yet. I've been busy, but I plan to start working out this weekend. Another week passed, and Janelle stopped by again. She was running on the treadmill, lifting weights, and had revamped her diet. So, what about you, chick? What have you been doing? What had I been doing? Well, I got sidetracked by brunch and dinner invitations, but I did manage to start a marathon. A Netflix marathon on the couch. But of course, I didn't share this with Janelle. Oh, I've been so busy. I just haven't had a chance to get started yet. I plan to start running this weekend. I didn't. Another week flew by, and Janelle stopped by yet again to check up on me. I could see the difference her new lifestyle was making. She'd already lost 10 pounds. Always the fashion plate, as she strutted toward me, I noticed she was wearing a new outfit. So, how's it going with you, chick? How is it going with me? Well, I ordered Mexican takeout for dinner almost every night and watched a few Netflix documentaries, although I did buy and read a women's fitness magazine. Yes, I didn't share any of this with Janelle. Oh, I didn't get a chance to train yet. I've just been so busy. Swamped, but I plan to start this weekend. She looked at me with one eyebrow raised as she tapped her manicured fingernails on my desk. Okay, Missy, but you really should start training soon. This back and forth went on week after week for the next 4 months. As Janelle grew increasingly slim and fit, she also became increasingly frustrated with me. I swear, I always had the intention of starting to train, but there was always something. Happy hour, a late night at work, brunch, dinner, Netflix. So week after week, I continued to delay the start of my workout routine. And then, before I knew it, there were only 2 weeks left until the 2011 Men's Health Conference. And I had not worked out at all. Not even a little bit. In fact, I think I even gained some weight. Meanwhile, Janelle looked great. Even though she's married and the mother of two little kids, she still somehow managed to find the time to train between work, husband, kids, and school, among everything else. Meanwhile, being responsible for no one but my single, lazy self, I had no good excuse for not getting started. One day, Janelle called me at work. I guess she got tired of stopping by. We had our usual exchange before she finally confronted me. Listen, Vicky, this is very important to me. Her tone was serious. Janelle is not a serious person, so it really took me aback. I really want to finish the race, so if you don't think you'll be able to do it, you should really let me know now. It's not too late to drop out. She was giving me an ultimatum. Start training or pull out of the race. She was determined to reach her goal of finishing, and I was potentially holding her back. All of a sudden, I felt really guilty. No, I'll do it. I won't let you down, I promise. I hoped that was true. 1 week to go before the 2011 Men's Health of Annapolis, and I finally started training. With little time left, I had no choice but to work out intensely every day, alternating running and hot yoga. No drinking, no eating out, no Netflix. It was apparent right away that I was out of shape. But I tried not to get discouraged. I just needed enough stamina to finish the race, even if it took all day. As the big day drew near, I gradually felt myself getting stronger. I became increasingly more confident about finishing, but was still filled with nervous anticipation. The day before the Urbanathlon, and Janelle had a plan. Our team would meet at her house right after work, sleep over, and head early to the race the next morning, which was set to start at 7 a.m. This would give us time to review the race course the night before, get a good night's sleep, and wake up early for a power breakfast. Things didn't quite go as planned, no thanks to me and our other teammate, Monique. I decided the night before was the perfect time to buy new racing gear, so I at least looked the part. Monique, it turned out, had transportation issues. We didn't arrive until 10:30 that night. Oh, my God, I'm going to kill you two. Janelle still smiled as she greeted us, and we laughed, but the guilt crept back into the pit of my stomach. She looked stressed. We quickly settled in, and Janelle pulled up the Urbanathlon website. You guys looked at the course online, right? Two blank stares looked back at her. Oh, my God. Seriously? You bitches are going to give me a heart attack. I'm going to walk you through the obstacles. This is important, so pay attention. Janelle would lead us off and take the first part of the course followed by Monique. I would be the team's anchor and take the last 3.5 miles of the course, which included two big stair climbs, one at Arthur Ashe Stadium and the other at Citi Field. It looked intimidating, but I thought I could handle it. Here's a video of the last obstacle before the finish line. Vixter, this is all you. She pushed play. Gladiator-style music started pumping as a trio of large, burly men in tight t-shirts appeared over the horizon. They were grunting and very sweaty, but almost at the finish line until they encountered the last obstacle, or more accurately, group of obstacles. First, there were two taxicabs that they proceeded to jump and roll right over. Then a mesh net that they had to crawl underneath on their stomachs, followed by a big yellow school bus. A school bus! With a rope net laid over it. They used the net to climb over the school bus, up one side, and then down the other. They ran a few more feet before encountering the final obstacle, a giant wall standing between them and the finish line. It was huge and completely smooth. How are they supposed to get over it? All along the wall were hanging ropes. They proceeded to pull themselves up to the top of the wall using just the strength of their big, muscular arms. They went up and over and finally crossed the finish line victorious before the music ended. I was horrified. I can't do that. I can't jump over taxis, let alone climb over a school bus, and I definitely won't be able to make it over that wall. There's no way. The three of us stood there, silent. To top everything off, did I mention that weather reports were predicting a big snowstorm the next round? Yeah, that's right. A random early blizzard in the middle of October, and of course, it had to fall on the day of the race. Not only did the Men's Health Urbanathlon seem impossible on its own, we now also had to run the race and complete all of the obstacles in the freezing cold snow. Did I mention I hate the cold? My confidence was plummeting, and so was Janelle's. She looked at me. Maybe we shouldn't do it. She was starting to freak out. I don't know if I could do it. I just don't know. I looked at her. She had worked so hard to get to this point, and so had I, even if it was only for a week. We had to finish. There was no backing out now. No, we're still doing this. We can do it. I hoped that was true. The next morning, we woke up bright and early at 5:30 a.m. It was still dark, but Janelle's spirit seemed to have lifted. Ready, girls? I guess sleep gave her some newfound confidence. She was pumped and her energy was contagious. I was excited now. The adrenaline was starting to kick in. Yes! We're doing this! We got dressed, bundled up, and headed outside. It was freezing and raining. Everything worse than snow is freezing rain. Anyway, it was too late to back out now. We arrived at the official site of the Men's Health Urbanathlon. There were hundreds of people everywhere. People stretching, high-fiving, and jogging in place in their matching team outfits. There were a lot of big dudes, but there were other women there, too, which was somewhat reassuring. But I was still intimidated. Everyone looked really athletic. After a group hug, our team parted ways to take our positions for the relay. An announcer welcomed us to the 2011 Men's Health Urbanathlon! Silence. Suddenly, a loud horn blasted to signal the start of the race, and they're off! Janelle was up first. Meanwhile, I had to wait for an hour in the freezing cold for the last leg of the race. I jogged in place, trying to keep warm. At one point, I saw Janelle in a herd of racers as they ran past. Oh my God, she was covered in mud! I never thought I would see Janelle covered in mud unless I was at a fancy spa! I cheered her on. Go, Janelle! Woo! She looked tired. She was going strong. I knew Monique's turn was coming up, so I took my position before her final obstacle, the monkey bars. I saw her approach and cheered, "You can do it, Monique! I watched her struggle to grab the cold, wet bars as she slipped and tried and then slipped and tried again. Finally, she made it. Now it was my turn. I started running and felt myself warming up and energized by the crowd of racers around me. I ran for a little while before encountering the obstacles. First, there was a tire run. It was slippery and muddy, but I carefully hopped through the tires with no problem, as one guy tripped and bit the dust right next to me. Ow! I didn't look back. It was every man for himself now. Half a mile later came the stair climb at Arthur Ashe Stadium. I decided now was not the time to break my leg on a wet step, so I carefully jogged up each flight of stairs, holding the handlebars to the top of the stadium, and then making my way back down. Before I knew it, I made it through. Next, City Field. As I approached the stadium, people were standing along the sidelines, cheering. I was having a rocky moment as I heard the theme song playing in my head. I couldn't wait. I couldn't wait to meet my teammates at the finish line. You're almost done. Keep going, a man cheered as we approached the stadium. A little kid high-fived me as I entered City Field. By the way, that man totally lied. We weren't even halfway done with the course. I noticed a few other racers hurting at this point after running the entire course. One poor guy was limping alongside me. We jogged up a ramp that wrapped around the entire circumference of City Field toward the top of the stadium. Then another stair climb. We climbed up and down the stairs, inside the stadium, facing the field, forming a snake of racers. It would be an understatement to say there were a lot of stairs, but again, I just took my time, slow and steady. Finally, we made our way back to the bottom of the stadium and ran through the clubhouse right into the middle of the playing field. Gladiator music blared, and people cheered us on as it began to snow. It was amazing. Suddenly it hit me. This was a once-in-a-lifetime experience, running in the middle of City Field with a view only the athletes get to see. And then City Field was behind me. I ran toward the last group of dreaded obstacles. This was it. I was almost at the finish line where Janelle and Monique were waiting for me. First up, the two taxicabs. I didn't jump over them like the men in the video, but I did manage to roll clumsily over the net, the mesh net. I crawled underneath it, piece of cake. And then the school bus. Did I mention I'm afraid of heights? I swear it looked even bigger than it did in the video. I took a deep breath and carefully climbed the cargo net without looking down, up one side and down the other. I made it, almost there. I stop in my tracks. There it is. The wall. Holy shit. I look up. It must be 100 feet high, and I'm suddenly paralyzed. I hear the other racers grunting and panting, a few brushing past and bumping me as they charge the wall. I continue to stand there, looking up, crestfallen and exhausted. There's no way I'm going to make it over. It's too high. Game over. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, I hear a voice. Hey, let me help you. I look over, and this rather cute guy is on instructions. I'll lift you up, and my friend up there is going to grab your hands and help you over. I look up, and there's another guy poised at the top of the wall. I soon notice that there are helpers, people along the entire length of the wall, helping the wounded and weary make it over. I look back at my knight-shining armor and smile, coyly. I'm ready. He puts his hands together. I place my foot into them, and he starts pushing me up as the other guy grabs my hands. I try with all of my might to pull myself to the top, but I just can't, and I start to flail. So the cute guy below pushes my butt up. He's even harder, groaning, lifting me up and over to the other side. Those two guys literally threw me over the wall. I made it! I crossed the finish line and meet Janelle and Monique. They're soaking wet and wrapped in these huge metal sheets that look like tin foil with Olympic-style medals around their necks as they cheer, jumping up and down. We did it! We did it! The 2011 medals for Manavala. 1 week later. I'm sitting at my desk at work, typing away, and stop for a moment to look at the Olympic-style medal hanging on my bulletin board. Janelle strolls by in a new, even slimmer-fitting, yet work-appropriate outfit. Hey, chick, what are you up to this weekend? I smile at her and answer without hesitation. I'm working out.
That's it. Thanks for joining us for this installment of No, You Tell It.
Visit us on the web at knowyoutellit.com.